Welcome to Deconstructed. I'm TJ O'Hara, the principal political analyst for IVN. Our goal on Deconstructed is to break down important political issues with outstanding guests so you can develop your own more informed opinion. My guest today is Joe Trippi, a longtime Democratic strategist who has worked on many presidential, gubernatorial, and United States House and Senate campaigns. Joe is currently a political commentator for CNN, and he's the author of a fascinating book entitled The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, Democracy, the Internet, and the Overthrow of Everything. He joins me today to provide insight into the past, present, and future of our nation's political environment. Joe, welcome to Deconstructed.
Thanks, TJ. Thanks for having me.
You know, you have a career that has spanned almost 40 years, and you've been involved in six presidential campaigns, Ted Kennedy's back in 80 being the first, and then Walter Mondale's, Gary Hart's, Jerry Brown's, Howard Dean's, John Edwards. You've seen a lot of change. How has the campaign environment at that highest level changed over the last 40 years?
Well, look, it's gotten faster. And of course, with digital and social media, a lot of the power, you know, which I think, or at least hope, eventually becomes a good thing, has shifted to the grassroots. But that also has clearly had other implications now in terms of tribalism and echo chambers. But it's a completely different playing field. I mean, back when I started in 79, first presidential, you know, there were essentially three TV stations in each market, ABC, NBC, CBS, and something called CNN was just starting, you know, essentially cable. So there were maybe three or four places that people were getting the bulk of their information on television. Now, so fragmented, and that's, again, shifted power away, which is a good thing, but how we're using it isn't exactly working out just yet, but hopefully it'll keep improving. But Trump, I guess, is a good example of how somebody can use the technology, use the different fragmented channels to actually harness and build their own network and succeed. It's just not the, at least for this Democrat, not the way I hoped it turned out.
I can certainly appreciate that. You know, you have not shied away from candidates that have faced some personal challenges and some media heat. Ted Kennedy, Gary Hart, John Edwards come to mind. But in 2004, when you were campaign manager for Howard Dean, effectively you had an outsider with actually almost no name recognition at the time when you started with him. He had a very big personality. He was good at ginning up excitement among crowds, I thought he was very good in a rally format. And very similar to somebody else we have today. And he was destroyed by the media, in my mind, somewhat unfairly over one issue, which I thought they took wildly to the extreme. How did you see that campaign being treated by the media? Was it fair in your opinion, or do you feel, as I did at the time, that they perhaps overreacted? And if so, why?
Well, I mean, look, anytime you, I mean, first of all, the media shifts. So when you first start out and you're at 0 or 1% in the polls, you're kind of cute and cuddly and there's no real threat to anybody. And so a lot of the flaws sort of, they just don't report. No one's going to stop the presses at the New York Times and say some guy you never heard of and will never hear of just said X, you know, said something crazy. So in a lot of ways you get the benefit of being that outsider with no chance. You don't have a whole lot of scrutiny and they actually enjoy watching you start to take off, and it's an interesting thing to report on. And then you become real and the rules change. And at that point, if you do anything with the entire planet out there trying to take you down, if you give them ammunition, they're going to use it. And frankly, what happened was a bad mic, bad advance in terms of using that mic. No one in that room, in that auditorium, could hear him. I was in the back of it with the press. You couldn't hear Howard talking. That's why he was yelling so loud to be heard, because the way the audio system was working. But on TV, you know, that mic was full blast into people's homes, and the media went overboard on it. But in the end, that's how this thing worked. A lot of campaigns rise on that same press lift, the same turbulence, that same pocket of air that takes you up can take you down. And that's really what happened in the Dean campaign. It was, you know, a whole bunch of people run for president. Yeah, I keep telling people that you know, something like, I don't know, 123 Democrats have run since 1968, three have won, you know, Carter, Clinton, and Obama. So you can clone yourself and run all 127 times, and you're going to be, you know, that's the odds. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Some gaffe, some running out of money, something is going to take most of them out of the race, and very few actually have the opportunity to actually succeed and get the nomination. I was there with Vice President Mondale when he did in 84, but still, out of those two, one, Ronald Reagan, gets at that point reelected to the presidency. It is one of the toughest things any candidate and team can accomplish. And hats off to those who have, but it's a very few people. And like I said, I can go through what most of them don't ever get to where Howard Dean got. I mean, particularly if you're a long shot and an asterisk in the polls, you don't get to emerge at some point as a front runner. Very few. Gary Hart, maybe in 84, got close to upsetting the front runner Mondale, but fell short. Same thing. Once you get some altitude, it's a real dangerous place to fall from.
Now, you brought up money, Joe, and that's become an enormous barrier to attracting qualified candidates. The hurdles necessary to gain ballot access for an independent are almost insurmountable, but the money necessary to be able to put together the types of media campaigns that are required today has grown astronomically since around 2008. So what do you see as the evolution of that? Is that going to continue, or are we going to attract candidates who I feel are more followers than leaders in most cases, people who need the money and the infrastructure because they're so focused on winning that they're willing to surrender the ability to exercise independent decision-making, and they capitulate to the party platforms in return for that money and infrastructure?
I actually think they're not. Most of them aren't capitulating to the party platforms anymore. And that's one of the things that has changed since the Dean campaign, with the ability to get grassroots and netroots contributions. I think you're seeing, I think you saw that with Bernie Sanders in the last cycle in 2016. And I think you're seeing it in all kinds of House and Senate races this year, in terms of candidates who are able, who actually would have no chance in terms of trying to get status quo establishment money of either party, are actually being sustained and staying alive because they've got the freedom of speaking out and raising money because of the energy they create. But that too can have its problems, because then if on a different issue, there's no such thing as agreeing with all the people that are contributing to you. But I do think that's a big plus that's happened, is that we're seeing, and I think that's why you're seeing more candidates. I think that's why you'll see in 2020 a lot, you know, we may have a big field in the Democratic side, but I also don't, usually what happens is, after first, second, or third in Iowa or New Hampshire, if you aren't on that list, you don't have, your money dries up and you're out of the race, and only the two or three survive. I think that candidates are going to survive much further than those early states because of their capacity to build their own network, raise their money through the grassroots, and sustain themselves past Iowa. You know, they don't have to win or take second. I mean, that's obviously going to be good and it will supercharge their money. But if they've got a following, they're going to be able to last longer. And that could well be a different kind of 2020 in terms of how those a bigger field going much deeper into some of these states, that it'll be interesting to see who emerges out of all that.
Well, Joe, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about campaign politics when we come back. Welcome back. Our guest is Joe Trippi, a renowned Democratic strategist and currently a political commentator for CNN. Joe, you're also working on a campaign out in the California area in California's District 50 with a new candidate by the name of Amar Campa-Najjar. And it's a very, very unique nature of a campaign in a top two state. We have an incumbent who's been indicted for a variety of charges, but he also has deep name recognition And he's in a district that's conservative. And I just checked the most recent polls. There's anywhere from a 2 to 15% deficit for your candidate to overcome. What is the approach when you're facing those types of hurdles, and yet you have a unique opportunity with a candidate that's particularly vulnerable that you're running against?
Well, I mean, this is actually another one of those where Omar Campa Najjar has been sustained by a lot of the contributions that are coming in online, which has actually made it possible for, I mean, he's outraised Duncan Hunter in the last few quarters and through the campaign, which is upside down. It's unheard of. Until this cycle, it's been unheard of for, you know, a challenger to outraise an incumbent. But we're seeing that not just with Omar, but, you know, in many, many of these races right now that are going on. But it's what's kept him, those resources. He's talented and he's connecting. You can see it out there. And our own polling has shown it essentially being a dead heat. So we're feeling pretty good here the last few days of the campaign. We've got to make sure that we're getting the vote out and all the things that a strong campaign needs to do to win. But Omar's really positioned well. And again, it's his message. It's who he is. He's putting country above party and bringing people together. You know, a guy who was a janitor in his church and rose up and served in the White House, who really is trying to put the hyper partisan stuff off to the side, in which Duncan Hunter is a hyper partisan, not to mention the indictments and everything else. But that is true. What you said is true. This district, the California 50, is a very red district. The Hunter name, mostly because of his father, which is actually part of the shame of all this, is that just the hubris of Duncan Hunter Jr.'s mistakes and the money he's taken and doing things like taking the money and saying that you were actually buying things for veterans charities with it while instead you were pocketing it. I mean, it's not just that he's hyper partisan, but this is the poster child for what everybody, I think, thinks is a caricature of what happens in Washington, but he's it. And at the same time, because we're in this hyper-partisan, polarized period, there are a lot of people who still look past all that and say, no, a Republican, no matter how bad, and vote for him, which is why we're in this dead heat. But Mark, I think, has surprised a lot of people. I know this race was not on the map. Even after the indictment, there were a lot of people just said they'll still didn't think that that a Democrat could close the gap. I think we have. Now the question is, can in the closing days, can we get that last push and take it over the top? But I think it's possible. He's working his heart out.
As someone who lives in the 50th district, I do have to share with you, I understand that the shortest distance between two points in the world of politics is go negative, but the advertising on both sides, Duncan Hunter's advertising is uncalled for. I'm not even going to acknowledge what he suggested about Campa Najjar's campaign, but Campa Najjar's campaign has also, at least in the literature, focused on the unfit to serve aspect as opposed to his campaign positions. And the reason I want to just touch upon that with you, at least briefly, in the Mondale Ferraro campaign back in 84, they ran a very liberal campaign and spoke out against Reagan's economic policies and so forth, and absolutely got crushed. Is that a reason why he's not presenting perhaps his policy positions because he's in a more of a conservative district? And is that why he's gone the Holder route rather than the Michelle Obama, you know, when they go low, kick them, as opposed to when they go low, go high?
No, I mean, look, I think the problem is that Hunter's, you know, the Union Tribune, San Diego Union Tribune, is literally editorialized repeatedly about how despicable the ads that he's been running are. They're just completely, like you said, you don't even want to give them any air here because of the just complete bigotry and falsehoods in them. And so when faced with that, the reality is this campaign became about character. And once it becomes about character, I mean, yeah, we all love to have a debate on the policy and the issues. And certainly Amar's put his ideas out there. But in the end, it has to be about character when you have the kind of assault that Duncan Hunter is waging in this campaign. And, okay, you want to have a fight about character? Well, that's a really dangerous place to go, Duncan, when you've got a 60-count indictment against you for taking $250,000 that wasn't yours and then blaming your wife for the whole thing. Let's talk about character. And that's where this campaign is, and we're happy to fight it out on those terms, is that's the turf he wants to fight on.
Now let's shift a little bit. Let's continue to focus on Kampa Najjar for a minute and compare him to the other rising Democratic stars, the rock stars, as they've sometimes been called. You've got Ocasio-Cortez, you've got Beto O'Rourke, Andrew Gillum, and they're being hyped pretty heavily by the party. And yet when former President Obama came out to Orange County to do a fundraiser and so forth, he mentioned certain candidates specifically, but he didn't mention Amar Kampa Najjar, who is a bright, young, articulate, energetic individual that you would think the party would be trying to promote. Is the party surrendering to the polls at this point in time or just hedging their bets? What's driving the lack of obvious party support for him?
I think a couple of the things. I mean, I think first is particularly, we came on the scope very late. I mean, there have always been 5, 6, 7 races in California that have been front and center, top targets of the party, and not just the party, but the Cook Report, Rothenberg. I mean, the people that rate these districts, there were 6 or 7 that were top targets, marginal seats that Democrats could win. And I think there was a lot of focus on them. And this district was so Republican in the past that it never made it onto any of those lists, but by independent ratings, you know, just never happened. And frankly, even after the indictments and things, people didn't really realize that Amar had been out there shoe leather, knocking on doors, talking to people, and had already closed a lot of that up by just winning people over one-on-one or in small group settings and campaigning around the district. So I think when people come in, they're going to these other districts for the most part. They don't even know this race is, I really don't believe a lot of them even know this race is on the map. And then you project that nationwide where there's like 89 targets. I have another race in Texas where we also kind of like climbed into the top tier late. And they're having the same, you know, it's that there was so, one of the things is we've got such strong candidates out there that some of our best are not getting the help they needed or the focus they need just because they didn't emerge till late in the game. But I think Amar Kampa Najjar is going to be a star in this party. The other thing I would say is there's a streak of independence in this guy that I think is also part of this. He's going to be somebody who's going to fight for that district, and he takes positions. Some of them are be in sync and others are totally not in lockstep with Democrats. Very independent. And I think that's part of what's going to make him a star, is that he's going to be a maverick who gets things done for that district. And he's so articulate and so charismatic that I think he'll be somebody that a lot of times you win these seats and everybody goes, oh, okay, great. Now with Duncan Hunter's, you're not running against Duncan Hunter. Good luck next time around. Now, I think with his independence, his work ethic, and his star power, I think Amar Kampa Najjar will be around for a while and make a big difference, not just to the district, but also I think to get, you know, he's the kind of Democrat that will get Republicans to think he's getting things done, which is really in the end what people want right now amidst all this polarization, is just please, you know, don't send me another polarizer. It's just, I'll stick with my own. And I don't mind somebody who's going to stand up for what they believe, but can they get anything done? Will they work to get things done? And Amar Kampa Najjar has that independent strength that I think he'll prove that.
Well, Joe, we're going to take a quick break and talk more about our changing political environment when we come back. Welcome back. Our guest is Joe Trippi, a renowned Democratic strategist, author, and political commentator. Joe, you know, we've been talking about the past and the present. Let's talk about the future a little bit. What do you see as being the impact of social media versus traditional media?
Well, I mean, it's obviously fragmented. It's empowering people to make a big difference, both message-wise and in creating buzz around a candidate and making a difference in races like Amar Camp and Najjar's down in San Diego. But it's been evolving. So I was talking about where you went from three stations to what we have today. And that's really been a big change. I mean, people have a powerful impact. When I, back in 1992, I've always had this real frustration with television. And so back in 92, it frustrated me that it was this one-way medium that you couldn't interact with. That voters couldn't consume, even the candidate couldn't. He just preached and we all had to listen. So that's when I, in the Jerry Brown campaign in 92, along with Joe Costello, who was working for him at the time, the two of us cooked up the 800 number as a way to put that on the screen, ask people to sign up for the campaign and contribute. And we raised millions of dollars. People said, well, that was a change. Well, no. It was a pioneering at the time, but that leads me to the Dean campaign in 2004, where now the internet is letting, it's not just, okay, just respond to this number, click here. We're actually having conversations on blogs and building our own network. Now with social media, that's now like on steroids, which by the way, leads to Donald Trump. I mean, he enters the race, gets 17, 18 million Twitter followers. He's now having a direct conversation with his followers the way the Dean campaign did on the Dean for America blog. Very similarly, I would get up in the morning, post something on the Dean for America blog, as would Howard, and then our 650,000 followers would comment all day long on the blog, and then I would interject or Howard would interject. And in the middle of the 2016 campaign, I'm watching what Trump's doing, and I'm saying, oh my God, Twitter is his blog. It's like he's taken the entire platform and turned it into what we did on Dean for America. He's the only candidate I've seen do something like that. And he didn't have to build his own platform to do it. It was sitting there waiting for him to engage with his followers directly, which he still does every day while the rest of us can't believe half the stuff he's saying to. Well, not only we can't believe 99% of the stuff he's saying to them, but you can build that direct network, that direct connection, and it is powerful. And I saw it in the Dean campaign when we only had 650,000 people who were doing that. You're now seeing what happens when 20 million, 30 million have that deep connection. I still think we're scratching the surface. There are 330 million Americans. We all did somersaults when Barack Obama got 3 million of them to give him $500 million. In the 2008 campaign and attracted the young people and inspired them. That was 3 million people out of 330 million. I mean, I think that's what I'm saying. I think we're still even now seeing kind of the infancy of a connected network and how powerful it could be if a candidate was actually able to engage and excite the country, not just a segment of it. And I think we'll see that. And hopefully that's what puts this democracy back on track. But I think that what we're seeing now is when somebody can get 20 million Americans engaged directly. And, that's actually kind of sad because, like I said, there's 330 million of us, well over 200 million voting age and registered. If we hopefully 2018, we start to see a pickup in how people start to actually participate and the participation numbers go up and hopefully social media starts to actually build that over time. And we see that candidate that connects directly with a lot more by bringing the country together instead of trying to get 20 or 30 million isolated and in their own echo chamber in support of someone like Donald Trump.
Jill, we're a little short on time, but I do want to briefly have you touch upon the impact of the demographic shift. You talked about age, the shift towards millennials and Gen Xers. They have different interests. They receive information in a different way, just as we were talking about social media. And of course, later down the road in 5 or 10 years, particularly among the millennials, that reality check hits when they become the taxpaying majority. How do you see millennials and Gen Xers impacting the electorate going forward?
Well, first of all, they're bigger than they'll be bigger in this election than boomers will be. So they have amazing power if they actually vote. I mean, a lot more power, I think, than they know right now. But as you point out, over time, that's only going to increase. The reality is, though, and we saw this in the Jones campaign in Alabama, all the traditional, we were buying television and radio and seeing huge movement among anybody over 45 with those mediums. But under 45, nothing was moving, nothing, until and unless we targeted that group or segments of it with digital and social media campaign. And as soon as we did, we started to see that different mix of digital and social media actually started to move the younger age groups again. Not just millennials and Gen Xers, but people in their 40s and even a little higher than that now. You know, you're seeing digital and social media more impactful than television and traditional media. That's only going to change as those generations get older and their still medium of choice is digital. And in fact, as we know, that's all blurring anyway. I mean, what's TV and what's digital streaming now? So I think that we're going to see a big sea change with millennial participation and their power. And I also think you're going to see a big change in shift. You're seeing it already, shifting more and more away from spend on traditional media and more towards digital, social media, and other kind of targeting and data. And in the Jones campaign, I can tell you when you went by 23,000 votes, it was that we actually probably spent more on digital than any Senate race in history up till then. I'm sure there'll be in this cycle now in 2018 people that do more than we did, but it was a Herculean effort in terms of shifting the budget in a way that made a big difference, and I think it did.
Well, Joe, in the limited amount of time we have left, where can our listeners go to learn more about you and the candidates you're assisting?
I guess at this point, the best thing to do is follow me on Twitter at Joe Trippi. I think that's a place where I try to keep in touch with people and put up thoughtful, you know, either retweet things I think are useful, and particularly here in the last few days and into the next cycle, you know, polls and other things that I think are interesting. So that may be the best place. And there's a link to my website on there too. So that's a good place to go.
Well, that's great, Joe. You know, I've really enjoyed having you on the show today. You're refreshingly open and extremely knowledgeable when it comes to the nuances of political campaigns. So thank you again for joining me on Deconstructed.
Great to be with you, TJ, and have me back anytime. I really enjoyed it.